the 18th of May, 1987, and the regularly scheduled hearing of the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources.
Senate Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources will come to order. Clerk will note the members present. The others are excused. We've got a number of members of the legislature who are here to testify on various bills, so it would be the chair's intention to ask Senator Thorne to come up first on Senate Bill 1035. And then following that, we will ask Representative Agrons and Representative Anderson to come up on 3097, followed by Representative Olson and Trahern on 2758. Then we will do the executive appointments, and then we will go back to the land use bills. Okay. Let me first open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1035 and ask Senator Thorne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, Mr. Chairman, I have copies with your clerk, which will cover what I'm going to try to address today.
Okay.
Chairman, you should have some prepared testimony as well as a canned and gross version of Senate Bill 1035. And if you don't have that, let me know, but I believe that's what you should have. Chairman, I'm Mike Thorn, State Senate from State Senate District 29, which includes Umatilla, Wallowa, and Union Counties. I would like to begin by first asking the committee to amend the bill as per the hand and gross version of which I have provided copies. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to review for you briefly what those amendments are, and then at the end of my presentation on the amendments, ask your committee's indulgence in making that amendment so that at least the document we're talking about is consistent with what I would like to introduce.
Okay.
So I'll proceed with the amendments that you have presented to you. First of all, the bill, Section 1, simply adds Section 2. Section 2 is proposed to be amended, and Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just have you follow through the reasons. When a PUD or an entity qualified under Chapter 261 exercises a power of eminent domain, called condemnation, it shall compensate the condemned for the property taken, as well as the impact on the remaining customers who must carry the potential burden of higher costs of co-generated energy, plus any added costs as a result of the loss of the property adversely taken. Chairman, I try to give a quick example. Let's assume, for the sake of discussion, that this room has 100 chairs, and that for some reason or another we decide to pay for the room by charging people to come in and sit in those chairs. And let's assume that for the moment that the show is good enough that the chairs are full each time the doors open up. And let's assume then for some reason someone comes along and extracts 20 chairs from the room. But if you were to apply the total cost of constructing the room and divide that by the chairs, you would come up with a cost per chair. But if you were to take 20 chairs out and only were paid for just the cost of those chairs on the basis of the 100, the fact of the matter is then the remaining 80 chairs would have to carry the full overhead or the full cost to support the cost we incurred originally. That's the theory involved in the amendment that I've asked the committee to consider in Section 2. Essentially, it's an attempt, if you condemn something, you ought to at least make the condemned whole in the process. Then, Mr. Chairman, Section 3 of the amendments offered restore subsection 3 and 4 of the original bill and delete the new language of the original bill beginning in lines 4 and extending through 21 on the second page. So therefore, Section 3 begins with basically a new proposal, which you'll note on the hand and gross version is Section 5. Basically, Mr. Chairman, those amendments give the commissioner the authority, the public utility commissioner the authority, to look prospectively at contracts between qualifying facilities and public utilities. for the purpose of trying to make sure that the spirit of those contracts entered into initially is maintained and that there is a review when deemed appropriate and prescribed by rule by the commission. The purpose of the new language is not to eliminate cogeneration, but simply make sure that the assumptions made at the time the contracts are entered into do in fact hold through the life of the contract. I have looked at some of the contracts presently, Mr. Chairman, and find that language not dissimilar to that is contained in them. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the amendments, and I would like to then ask that your committee, if it's appropriate, consider those as the bill that I'd like to discuss now. For the sake of the record, Mr. Chairman, maybe you didn't catch that request. I would like to make it clear that my comments address the amended bill. And
no, that's understood.
Okay.
That's understood.
I'll proceed then with the rest of my comments. Mr. Chairman, as you know, I represent an area of the state where cogeneration has become a significant portion of the energy supply for CP National, which is an electrical utility company that serves Baker and Union County. The utility has a load of approximately 60 megawatts, with approximately 15 megawatts coming from cogeneration, and the potential of a growth to approximately 25 megawatts, or nearly one half of its energy supply from cogenerated electricity. My office has reviewed all of the contracts that are presently in force, and without exception, they contain two essential elements. First, there's an automatic escalation clause, and secondly, there is provision which does give the Public Utility Commission the opportunity to review those contracts, qualified as it may be. And if your committee would care, Mr. Chairman, I can provide you copies of those through my office if you would deem that appropriate in your review. Recent rate increase requests have elevated the potential of severe economic impact on electrical users called the consumers in my district, and thus the reason I'm before you today with this proposal. My concerns became acute when the major wood products company of the area that I represent expressed concern for its future operations in Northeast Oregon as a result of the potential cost of electrical energy. Temporarily, the immediate concerns have been alleviated somewhat in that the PUC has reduced the rate requested. However, the concern continues because the escalation clauses in the cogeneration contracts to which I referred to earlier. I realize the potential pitfalls of requiring the Commission to review biannually the existing contracts, and those were contained in the original bill, and therefore ask for the amendments to make the contract review prospective. I realize this does not bring immediate relief to the situation so far. However, the fact remains that cogeneration will continue, and I believe the best policy for us is to establish now the requirement that future cogenerated electrical contracts would be subject to the review in order to provide a check and balance on behalf of the ratepayers of this state and the future of Oregon's economy. The situation involving the use of condemnation arose when a PUD formation was rumored in part of the CP National Service Area, which would have creamed the area not served by cogeneration, leaving the higher cost load on that portion of the district which did not have cogeneration. The portion of the bill relating to the use of eminent domain, a condemnation if you will, seems to me to be a matter of fairness. If you take something, you should have to pay for it. Mr. Chairman, I realize this proposal does not alter the existing cogeneration rate structure, and I believe that that is an assignment that the legislature may want to consider throughout the coming interim as a possible study project. It is not my intent, nor is it the intention of the printed amendments to in any way harm cogeneration contracts now in effect, but it does suggest that the PUC assume continuing jurisdiction in the public interest. Most emphatically, I'm not suggesting that the bill be set aside for the sake of the study, but I believe your attention should be directed to one element untouched in this proposal, and that's the relationship between the utility and the qualifying facility presently in place. Mr. Chairman, in the hearing room today are many who have expertise to answer your specific questions, and I would encourage you to call upon them and in the meantime express to you my appreciation for your courtesy in allowing me to present this proposal somewhat late in the session. However, I've been working on it since the beginning. If there's questions, I'd be happy to try to respond.
Senator Thorne, in terms of your amendments, the additional language, sub 2 of section 2.
Yes.
Can you make a little bit more sense out of that for me? I'm having a little trouble. I just don't quite understand it.
Mr. Chairman, the intent is to make it clear that if there is the exercise of the power of eminent domain, and if the Public Utility Commissioner, or when the Commission determines what the value of that total compensation should be, then it says that the Commission shall direct that all additional compensation received as a result of subsection 1, and that's determining what the value is, shall be passed on to those ratepayers, if you will, in that utility's remaining service area. In other words, using the example I use in this room and the chair example, if we figure there is need to be a 20% charge for the cost impact on those remaining, then that 20% benefit should accrue to those people that have to pick up that cost. It's not unlike the use of the same power of eminent domain when you have a highway condemnation case and you cut off a piece of property. You pay for the property, plus you have to compensate the owner for the inefficiencies or the other losses that accrue as a result of someone exercising that power of eminent domain. And that language makes it clear that that once that's determined, it does not go to the bottom line of the profit line of the utility, but is indeed transferred to the ratepayers. So there's the ones that are stuck paying the extra cost. So this is a way of writing down that cost.
Okay. Senator Cohen.
That same issue then, this goes beyond cogeneration issues too. I'm just trying to get a fix on what's to be included here in terms of that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, the language does not restrict itself just to cogeneration. However, the reason that the two are tied together in the proposal is, let's assume that some action of the commission were to drive down the cost of those cogeneration contracts. I'm fearful that without some protection, we could have a situation, as I described in my testimony, where a portion of the district might be set up for takeover by another entity, leaving the folks left in a situation of almost being untenable in terms of the rate cost. So this is simply a general protection for those that are left in the rare case that this power were exercised.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. I've asked, this is a public hearing, so I've sent committee staff to get a good opinion on whether we can adopt your amendments or whether we can just accept these as the bill you're proposing and leave it at that for now.
Whatever it is, Mr. Chairman, I want to clear that the original bill is not
what you're promoting at this moment.
Interested in, and appreciate the courtesy you've extended in allowing me to do that.
I did have one other question, and it relates to currently, the cogeneration contracts are under PURPA.
That's correct.
And PURPA basically, through both congressional action and through some court action, has been clearly defined as basically intended to encourage cogeneration, not just allow it, but to encourage it. How do you feel your proposal as it relates to cogeneration interacts with federal law on the encouragement of cogeneration?
Mr. Chairman, it's my feeling, and I'm certainly not an expert on PURPA, but it's my feeling that it essentially is neutral on the question. What the spirit of that amendment tries to say is that At the time a qualifying facility and electrical or utility enter into a cogeneration contract, whatever the assumptions are there, they ought to hold true throughout the period of the contract. Presently, with the escalation clauses that exist in some of the contracts that I've looked at and the potential kilowatt hour price going as high as 25 cents, there's a real opportunity for windfall built into the contract, set and fixed, and the ratepayers are going to pick that up, and maybe the fundamental economics over the life of the contract do not follow that assumption that was used when those contracts were entered into. So I really think that if it's a good deal at the time you enter into it, it ought to be a good deal throughout the period of the contract, but you ought not allow someone to make an unreasonable profit in the process at the expense of the ratepayers, and that's who's going to pay the bill.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, I want to then close the hearing on 1035, open the hearing on 3097, Representative Agrons and Anderson. This is the Destination Resorts Bill.
The bill is sent here, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we're very grateful for your attention to this problem today. I'd like to give you a little background information on how we got here and develop an understanding of what has happened up until this point with this piece of legislation. I have to say at the outset that this is my own first adventure into the wonderland of land use regulation, and it has been a challenging and interesting and exciting experience for me, also one in which I'm not at all expert at this point, and Representative Anderson, who is one of the resident experts on the House committee, has been most helpful, as has the chairman of that committee and others, and he is here today to help me out when I get in trouble. I would like to point out to you that the origination of this bill did not occur in my head, but rather was brought to me by one of the members of the Klamath County Board of Commissioners, who incidentally is the quote-unquote environmentalist on our board. That is Roger Hamilton, who came to me early in the session and said that I think that we already have historically had small destination resorts in Klamath County, that they have served a worthy purpose, that there is a potential for others as we develop over the years, and that the current regulations, as they are embodied in the policies of the LCDC, are so restrictive as to totally preclude your possibility, and we really believe that it is time to take another look and see what might be done to site small destination resorts on, if you will, for want of a better term, the secondary resource lands. We consider that it is an economic development issue for Klamath County, all and perhaps in other parts of the state, not a major one. I don't expect that people are going to rush right out and cite these things all over the place, and yet we know that there are some places for them. And bringing it to me, Commissioner Hamilton pointed out that the present exceptions process has been patched time and time again, and that, I'm reading his words now, since 1973 has left us with a convoluted, complex, and nearly impossible set of criteria to understand or to meet. And until the state exceptions process is completely rewritten, we'll see more and more bills, such as this one being introduced. That was Commissioner Hamilton's feeling. And so, House Bill 3097 resulted and was brought to the Environment and Energy Committee in the House, whereupon Chairman Cease expressed a considerable interest and felt also that it was a worthy purpose. We wound up with some considerable amendment and refinement of the original bill. The version that you have before you, having been worked out both in work sessions with the committee and in an ad hoc fashion by a small committee that was designated by Chairman Cease to include and be headed up by Representative Anderson, who sits to my right as he normally does. And I say that with affection. Mr. Russ Nebon, who is the Marion County planner and who had worked with the Association of County Planners to provide the nucleus of the first draft of the bill and who have taken an interest in the bill. Mr. Nebon was a participant in our negotiations. We were joined by Mr. Dick Benner of the Thousand Friends of Oregon, who participated and was a party to the bargaining. And at the final session, we were joined by the administrator of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. What's his name?
Jim Ross.
Jim Ross, of course. I know it as well as my own. Anyway, Mr. Ross joined us for the final negotiations, and the product you now have in front of you. This bill responds to the current difficulty in citing small destination resorts in rural areas, and as you know, and as I've said, the exceptions process is lengthy and costly. And I should say, in Klamath County, during the acknowledgement process, only one needs exception has ever been approved. House Bill 3997 simplifies the process for citing small destination resorts in rural areas by, number one, setting standards for siting small-scale resorts. Number two, incorporating Goal 8 standards for large resorts into state law with a few changes. And number three, requiring LCDC to adopt permitted land uses for secondary resource lands, which can be used for small destination resorts. As I said, we had the cooperation of DLCD and 1,000 Friends of Oregon in crafting this bill, and we tried very hard to strike a balance between the needs of rural communities to develop their tourism potential and the necessity to protect the state's natural resources. We did not want to encourage a proliferation of roadside motels, and most of the amendments to the original bill were made to discourage that type of development. Now, small-scale resorts in this bill would be allowed on non-farm and non-forest land in exception areas and on secondary resource lands designated by LCDC. They'd be permitted on 20 acres or more. If at least 25, but no more than 75 units, and would have a seating capacity in the restaurant to match that number of units. The investment requirement is at least $1 million in investment in the improvements, and it is qualified by having to be adjacent to a unique recreational activity in a rural area. Small-scale resorts also could not be located closer than a half a mile for each 25 units to a high-value crop area. The bill also incorporates certain provisions of House Bill 2758, which passed this House, passed the House of Representatives, not the Senate, to allow destination resorts as a conditional use in EFU zones, and I believe you have that bill up for consideration, too.
We're going to hear that next
year. Yeah. That bill was drafted earlier to take care of a narrower problem. Ours came along, and council felt that we should duplicate portions of that bill in this bill. So you may want to look at that. And I'm sure you'll hear from the folks in Josephine County. They may have some other ideas. Finally, this bill requires LCDC to adopt permitted land uses for secondary resource lands by July 31st, 1988. I guess that some modest changes to Goal 8 that were incorporated allows hookup to existing water and sewer service so long as they pay for it. It further allows destination resorts as a conditional use in the FU zones. It sets standards for small-scale resorts and specifically includes secondary resource lands as possible for location of destination resorts. We also amended the qualifying overnight lodging from 48 to 45 weeks, and we require mapping only of the large destination resorts, not the small destination resorts. That essentially is an outline of what the bill does and some of what it doesn't do, and we'd like to answer any questions you might have or discuss it in any fashion that suits the committee.
Okay, other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Bernie did a great job. I won't comment how long it took him to do it.
3 minutes.
We'll see how long it takes you.
There's just two or three items that I might cover to clear up a few things. We did make some changes. We used to have 30 airline miles, and it seemed like, again, there were some... There was always some destination resorts that were 29 miles away. The negotiation with Thousand Friends and so on, we reduced that to 25 airline miles, which will seem to open the door for a couple of more resorts. When we're dealing with secondary resource lands, we had a lot of testimony on that. We even had other bills in regard to secondary resource, which is the old marginal lands. It seems that the task force from the interim is very close to coming together with closure and will be recommending to the commission. They apparently are going to develop the many standards that the federal government has on classifications of land. We've used that archaic 1-6 long enough, and now we're going to have some new standards that will more realistically tell us on their ability to grow crops, trees, and etc. So, in the last section of the bill, go way over here, you might think it's almost hidden. Section 11 on page 8, we say the commission shall adopt and submit a definition of secondary resource lands and uses permitted in secondary resource lands to the committee, that means the Joint Land Use Committee, by July 31, 1988. But we put the key word in there, shall adopt. Thousand Friends and the whole world did sign off on that because we thought this, again, was going to make a push to once and for all, finally, within 1 year from now, get the commission to adopt and define secondary resource lands in the state of Oregon. So the bill does a lot. Think it's a good bill, necessary, and most everything in here was signed off on most of the major players. I can't honestly tell you that the Oregon Realtor Association has signed off 100%, but close. I would recommend perhaps only one little change on page 2, line 4, where we talk about it must be open for rental to the general public for 45 weeks. We would suggest that we reduce that just 1 week to 44 weeks, which would allow 12 weeks, which would coincide with 3 months that a person is trying to rent out some space for a season or something like that. They could say, yes, it's available for 3 months, albeit you're 2 days short or so on in there. That 1 week, I don't believe, would give heartburn to too many people, a Thousand Friends or so on, but that was a request that came in a little late, that the perception of 3 months was better than 45 weeks, but 12 weeks there.
Okay, other questions? Anything else, Representative Anderson? Thank you both very much. Let's go briefly then. We'll close the hearing temporarily on House Bill 3097, go to House Bill 2758. We've got Senator Olson and Representative Traher is here. And one person from Josephine County signed up. So you want to go ahead and bring your person too.
Perhaps, Madam Chair, if I just might begin and run back to another committee where I've got another bill going right now. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2758. I don't need to share with any of the committee members here certainly the importance and the prospect of siting a destination resort and what that would mean to any of us in our own economies. I'm supportive of 2758, which allows for a destination resort to be sited in an EFU zone when it's consistent with the Goal 8 requirements. The governor, and I perhaps should make sure that you have copies of letters he's written to the county commissioners as well as to the mayor of Grants Pass, has agreed to support House Bill 2758. And the House did a fine job of making that a very narrow issue in the bill and won bipartisan support for that effort. I hope the Senate would pass the measure as they received it and the governor is ready and willing to sign it. And with that, I'd like to perhaps have Representative Traherne, who did a fine job on the House side, go into the details of what they did there, and then we certainly would like our planning department from the area to speak to the issue.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, State Representative George Traherne, District 49. Senator Olson said I was going to go into the details.
Like 12 years, they used to live on Church Street down here, up here and watch the dome of the old Capitol fall in when it burned. So I've been around this state and it is near and dear to me. But I've been a resident of Baker County for almost 40 years, 35 of which I've been in business. One of the things that I have learned is that an essential part of any con game, and that's speed. Do it now. Commit today, tomorrow it's too late, and so on. I hope we don't get conned on the Senate Bill 1035. There's lots of time. Thank you very much.
Mr. Haynes, you mentioned a solution that someone was going to speak to. Who would that be? And
Mr. Hemphill and so forth. They have an alternative idea.
And you are supportive of their idea?
Yes.
When they present the idea, we'll know that you're in favor of that.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Monroe.
It's the first time I've ever heard a Senate bill being heard for the first time 4.5 months into the session, perhaps 5 weeks from sine die, as being described as being on the fast track.
Well, that shows you how far we are away from sales. Mr.
Chairman.
Senator
Monroe.
Bills that were on the fast track have already been signed by the governor.
I guess it's a case of semantics, but to me a fast track, nobody heard of it out in the country, at least out where I live, and of course this is specifically addressed, as Senator Thorne mentioned, to the situation in Baker, where according to, I believe what he said, it was rumored that there was a possible PUD going to be formed and so on.
Any further questions? Senator Cairns?
No, that's fine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
for coming all the way over here.
Yes.
Very much appreciate it.
I appreciate you putting me on the front.
John Thomas, Dan Meek, Marion Hempel, I'll call on you if you promise to keep your testimony short, because we have a 5 o'clock floor session of the Senate, and I do have a number of witnesses who've come a long distance. So you're going to have to, Dan's going to have to condense his testimony, and you're going to have to make it brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Marion Hemphill, the Oregon PUD Association. If I may address the chair, do you still would have time to see some maps to put this in perspective?
Sure, I think that would be
good.
All
right, good.
We've been hearing a lot about...
Why don't you turn one of those mics around, or get near one of those mics anyway. There we go. Good.
We've been hearing quite a bit about the problem out in that Eastern Oregon situation, and I just wanted to take a minute of time here to put it in perspective as to what we're talking about.
Good.
The yellow area here is the area that's served by CP National currently. It includes Union County, Baker County, Grant County, and a portion of Harney County. you see that it is surrounded on all sides by other utility companies. This gigantic one down here in the corner is Harney County Co-op. Over here in the purple is all of Idaho Power situation. Up here is Pacific Power and Light. There's another small Idaho Co-op, Clearwater, here. Umatilla Co-op is on the other side. Columbia County Co-op is here. The green is Central Electric Co-op. So it is completely surrounded, and also does not have any of its own generation capacity other than what it's purchasing through the cogeneration contracts. CP National is a wholesale customer of Idaho Power that delivers it directly from there. If I can take just a minute more, a little bit better perspective on what we're talking about. The dark blue line that you see here is the territory of CP National. You see, when Mr. Haynes talked about taking the portion of Baker County that is served by CP National out of the territory, you're talking about this area right here, whereas the rest of Baker County, outlined in light blue here, is served by Idaho Power. CP National serves just this little tiny sliver right here of Malheur County, dips down into Harney County, goes down below Burns, and goes out into Grant County. Also, you've been hearing about the cogeneration facilities, and I have located those in red here for you. Here's the city of Cove. The city of Cove has a small hydro facility of about 0.6 megawatts. Down below it, we have two other Union County projects. We have the Time Energy cogeneration facility, which is at 6 megawatts. We have one that is not online yet, but it's called Energyology, and that's a very small unit of about 0.6 megawatts. Nothing here in Baker, as you can see. Over here in Grant County, we have Blue Mountain, which is a lumber facility, which is at 3.5 megawatts. Just down a little bit to the east is Prairie Wood Products at 7.5 megawatts. And then down here, just down below Burns, we have a facility that is not yet come online. It's been the subject of a recent appeals court decision, and it's my understanding that the proponents of the project are appealing that to the Supreme Court. When it comes online, it will be someplace between 20 and 29 megawatts, depending upon which version of the contract you read and exactly what it's going to come online. The appeal was for 20 megawatts, but at one time it was scheduled to come on in 29 megawatts. Now, what we're talking about in terms of rate shock was just four out of these six facilities, the small ones, not this big one down here. This one, which only total, 17 megawatts. We're talking about the fact that CP National filed for a rate increase of 36.23%. They seem to need nearly $9.5 million per year additional revenue. Consequently, the folks in that area took the time to try to decide what they could do in order to mitigate the rate shock. We are pressed for time at this point, so consequently I cannot go into the full history of how we got to where we are today, but let it suffice to say that the people in that CP National territory were scouring around, if you will, for a way to mitigate that rate shock and to get control of their future and their own destiny. We at first were approached by several people from out there, and today you heard from Mr. Richard Haynes. By the way, Mr. Haynes is a Baker City councilman. He's also the president of Farm Materials, which is a major business there. He's also on the board of directors, national board of directors of Ace Hardware company and a very active member of the Chamber of Commerce. I could go through the list of proponents in Union County, Baker County, and Grant County who have tried to form a PUD, and the I believe you would be impressed with the list. They include county court judges, county commissioners, city councilmen, members of the wood products industry and the lumber industry, very substantial citizens attempting to solve this problem. And quite frankly, we were at a loss as to what to do because we, too, would have the same kind of a situation with the cogeneration facilities.
A PUD would.
A PUD would. Right. That's right. Consequently, we have come up with an alternative solution to this problem that I would like to talk about, but not before I address the other components of the bill that we, in fact, determine as onerous, Mr. Chair, if we may. I would like to save the solution until the other two people that have joined me at the panel have been able to talk to the bill.
Fine, as long as they promise to be exceptionally brief.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Monroe.
Are you speaking, are all of you speaking to the bill as amended with the amendments Senator Thorne requested?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, we will in fact address that, although we were not given those until this hearing. We are prepared to address the amended bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kerry.
We're going to have future hearings on this bill, I think.
Yes, we are. Proceed. I just have a lot of people from Warm Springs and Douglas County and other places, and I want to be sure to hear from them.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't know about these witnesses, but it might serve their time as the maybe even yield their time to our out-of-town visitors and have them maybe return and give us a more expanded view of their testimony rather than trying to condense it at this point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cairns, I guess I would have no objection to that if we have the opportunity to come back and speak to the specifics of the bill. However, I would like to, since Mr. Haynes is present here today and has become, as of this afternoon, an incorporator of the Oregon Trail Cooperative, which will be the basis for the solution to the problem out there. I would like to very briefly run through that solution with you.
Why don't you do that? I think that would be productive right now.
No offense, Dan.
Give us a chance to read your brief, Dan.
We have a number of problems with the bill, and consequently, rather than just come in and say bad bill, which we were about ready to do, we really felt that it was incumbent upon us, since we seemed, the PUDs seemed to be the target of this particular effort, to try to work out a solution that was equitable and non-legislative in nature. Consequently, we have spent a good deal of time and bounced this idea off many people in the utility community, including the Bonneville Power Administration and others who would be direct participants in the solution. Basically, what we do is form the Oregon Trail Cooperative. And as a matter of fact, this afternoon, those articles of incorporation were filed with the Corporation Commission to form a cooperative that is contiguous with the boundaries of the entire CP National Territory, not just Baker County, but rather it's an entirety. Secondly, we would then need to approach CP National and attempt to negotiate an assignment of contract. That is, the cooperative would be assigned all cogeneration contracts. The third step is that the cooperative then would exchange the power with Bonneville Power Administration. What's different about what that is versus what happens now is that within the law, you can only exchange that portion of your load, your generation load, that is attributed to the residential and small farm consumer. Consequently, the only members that can join the Oregon Trail Cooperative are residential and small farm customers, therefore making 100% of the assigned cogeneration contract exchangeable with Bonneville. What that means is that we take the higher cost power from the cogeneration facilities, exchange it for Bonneville's average system cost and bring that back into the area in a paper transaction, which is illustrated down here. I'll get to in a second. Let me move this a little bit. I'm thinking mm-hmm. that you cannot see the bottom portion mm-hmm. of my my chart. We would exchange the power with the Bonneville Power Administration. Next, the cooperative would pay CP National to distribute the power on the existing system. That is, there would be no buyout, no sale, no transfer, no condemnation. Rather, the CP National stays in business, and the cooperative would pay the distribution costs of CP National. The full contract rate that is currently in the cogeneration contracts would be paid out of the Bonneville Exchange. So the cogenerators would be held whole. Next, the cooperative recovers its administrative costs, probably somewhat less than 5%, someplace between 3 and 5%, out of the rates. Lastly, the cooperative home and farm customers enjoy a reduced rate. CPN continues to serve the commercial and industrial customers with its own resources, whether they be continued purchases from Idaho Power or from any other generation source. This, we believe, and as a matter of fact, not only those of us at the panel here, but those that we've talked to in the Bonneville Power Administration and the energy community, including some of those that are in this very room, believe that this will in fact work. It will in fact mitigate the rate impact that Senator Thorne wants to have mitigated. We do not need legislation in order to put this into place. There will be no taking, there will be no condemnation, there will be no sale of property, provided that CPN is a willing participant in this. Now, I will be quite frank with you that this idea is very fresh and very new, and we have not had the opportunity to negotiate with CP National. However, we do have a fallback position if that does not work, but I'll go into that at some other future time. Thank you.
Terrific.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Monroe.
I assume then that you've not yet had an opportunity to discuss this solution with Senator Thorne or other legislators from that area.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, not in detail. We did have the opportunity to mention it in passing to Senator Thorne, and he did give it some consideration, but not full consideration.
Okay, both. If it's okay, both of you can come back. That's all right. I really appreciate your patience, and I'm sorry. Let me run through the list of people that I want to be sure to hear from before 5 o'clock. Ron Yoakam, Doug Morrison, Jim Noteboom, and Delvis Heath, Bill Vian, Richard Glick, and Michael Demos. Are people, as far as I can tell, from out of town. So why don't we start, and then the other, is Roy Burns here from Lane County? Okay, don't get him. I just want to, get him. He came up for one other hearing, and we didn't get a chance to hear from him. Okay, let's start with Ron Yoakam and Doug Morrison. Why don't you both come up at the same time? If you can keep your testimony brief, we'd really appreciate it, because we do want to hear from you. We just are really under a crunch here.
Senator Bradbury and members of the committee, my name is Ron Yoakam. I have presented some prepared testimony which related to the original bill. To be brief, I won't repeat it. I'm going to simply point out that with the original bill, we saw a very severe economic impact on our cogeneration plant. We're talking about 400 jobs that we felt would have been at risk if that bill had passed the way it is. I'm going to speak now to some of the comments that Senator Thorne made. First of all, I'd like to point out that this bill that Senator Thorne, 1035, has been working on, he's been working on for some time. It hasn't been an easy problem. It's not been an easy one to develop any solutions. And I have to give my appreciation to Senator Thorne, Senator Timms, and the various other representatives and senators in the area. The new amendments, as proposed, create kind of a dilemma for us. From a practical point of view, it grandfathers us in, and we would not see the impacts from it, both for our existing plant in Prairie City and the one we're building over at Riddle. From a philosophical policy point of view, it does impact us in the idea that if we ever wanted to build another cogeneration plant, we think the floating cogeneration rates would make it a little hard to obtain funding or would ever encourage anyone to want to build one. The other aspect of that is if we had to go forward our contracts for 20 years, we've got another 19 to go. In the year 20, it may be difficult to negotiate a contract that would be profitable. We're right now concerned that our contract rate in year 15 out of our 20-year contract may not be sufficient to cover our costs. Now, that's a risk we took when we signed the contract. We looked at semi-levelized costs and all that sort of thing. We're prepared to take those lumps. But we do think it'd be worthwhile to give some more thought to making these rates, looking to the future, go and both up and down if you are going to go with this floating rate. Again, that's just briefly the philosophical problem we have right now, and we're not prepared to really come down one side or the other on Senator Thorne's amendments. We do like what we've seen. It's a big improvement over where we started from. Thank you.
Senator Cairns.
Mr. Chairman, all things being equal, though, would you prefer us to send the parties who are involved in the Northeast Oregon question, brought us this bill to go and work on this solution presented here and not deal with those contracts at all by law?
I'm sorry, Senator, I don't think I totally followed your question.
What I want to know is whether you want us to do anything at all or whether the parties who brought us this bill would be better off to settle it this way without doing anything under the statutes.
I guess I'm not prepared to speak to that question without consulting with my principals, the owner of the company. I'm basically here on his behalf.
Would he be more satisfied if we did nothing than if we even did what the amendment Senator Thorne brought us?
That's difficult because I haven't had an opportunity to really go through those amendments with him. I'm sorry.
That's true.
That's the end of my comment.
I apologize. But can you refresh my memory where Prairie City is?
That's very easy.
Is it near John Day or is it? It's the one right next to John Day.
Right next to John Day. We're okay. 15 miles to the east of John Day.
Okay.
So our other facility.
It's that little dot right up there in Grant County.
Right. Our other facility is currently under construction. Hopefully, it'll be online late July, first part of August of this year. It's in Riddle, Oregon, just south of Roseburg.
Great.
Douglas Morrison, Northwest Pulp and Paper Association.
Welcome.
Pleased for the opportunity to state its opposition to Senate Bill 1035. We make this statement in opposition in regard to both the bill as it in its original form and in its hand and gross form. It may or may not solve the problem in Eastern Oregon. It has greater implications for the entire state. There's two things in this bill. Effective prohibitions on PUD annexations and effective prohibitions on cogeneration and small power producing facilities. Both of these are institutions which are established in the state under sound public policy. First, the restriction on PUD annexations in Section 2 is anti-competitive, and that would effectively prohibit annexations due to the increased cost burden. We testified earlier before the House Energy and Environmental Committee on House Bill 81. Efforts to restrict PUD annexations are intentionally anti-competitive. Section 2 of this bill would deny many industries the opportunity of seeking electric service in the open marketplace. There can be large differences in the price of electricity offered by the various utilities, and I've offered a price comparison there for you. It's attached to my testimony. Rather than minimize those differences by anti-competitive restrictions, we urge you to concentrate on mechanisms to increase competition in an effort to lower electric rates for all customers. We can do this through mechanisms such as presented in House Bill 2144 or incentive rates. Moreover, the process of condemnation and the issue of just compensation, which is a constitutional issue, appropriately takes place in a judicial forum. Any legislation to reform the definition of just compensation should be applicable to all condemnations by any public or quasi-public body and not selectively applied to PUD condemnations. And I can cite you some examples. Gas station on Mission Street to widen the road. Should they pay a 10-year cost of revenue? Should the state pay the 10-year cost of revenue to that gas station? How about the Paramount Theater in Portland? 10 years worth of revenue automatically put into the value of that property, or an a utility line across farms, 10 years worth of crop. Is that what we're talking about here? Summary, section 2 we feel is inconsistent with current public policy, and that policy is encouraging open energy markets and increased competition. As far as section 3 of the bill, restrictions placed on the development of facilities for cogeneration is against established public policy again. Under current federal, regional, and state policy, they all promote small power production and cogeneration facilities. Federal law encourages cogeneration resources, not large plants fueled by nuclear and fossil fuels. Congressional intent in the Northwest Power Act and the Regional Power Planning Council's 20-year energy plan give priority to cogeneration as a more efficient resource than other thermal power resources. State of Oregon reaffirmed that policy, and I believe this committee played a role in that, as recently as 1983 in continuance of Oregon's mini-PURPA. The review mechanism and price limitations in Section 3 establish an artificial barrier to those small power-producing facilities. This occurs in several ways. First, the variability in contract pricing will make it difficult to obtain financing for these facilities. Provision discriminates against smaller businesses, which may not have the resources to establish the credit for these expensive endeavors. Second, the PUC review process will burden existing and proposed facilities by forcing a perhaps continual review process, including contested cases and courtroom litigation. Small business, again, will be particularly affected due to the lack of resources to fund this litigation. Third, without the cogeneration electricity producing option available at the end of the current electrical surplus, Oregon would be in an unenviable position of encouraging construction of large thermal power plants. Finally, the bill effectively opens up the financial books of business to unnecessary PUC scrutiny. This again is contrary to Oregon and national energy policy, which seeks to reduce the financial regulation of small power production facilities. This bill is inconsistent with current state, regional, and federal energy policy. It sets up artificial barriers which add to the competitive burden of pulp and paper employers in Oregon. We urge you to take no action on this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Morrison?
It's pretty explicit.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Jim Noteboom and Delvis Heath. Welcome. Please be as brief as possible. We have 20 minutes till floor session.
I will take care of that, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it very much. My name is Jim Noteboom. I'm one of the attorneys for the Warm Springs Tribes. Today I have Delvis Heath with me, who is the chief of the Warm Springs Tribes and a lifetime member of the Tribal Council. In particular, at Warm Springs, this bill would have an impact because of the re-regulating dam project that the tribes built several years ago for $30 million, and in which the state is essentially a partner with us because they loaned us $15 million. The project is important to the tribes because the tribes use revenue from that project to fund such essential governmental services as police, fire protection, ambulance services, court systems, social programs, and so forth. The proposed amendments don't particularly solve the problem either. It takes care of the situation with the current power sale contract. That contract will expire in 2001, and the tribe takes a long-range view of their revenue needs and where their income is going to come from to fund these services, and it would affect the second, the subsequent power sale contract. In addition, the tribes on the reservation have two primary economic natural resources. One is forest, and the other is hydropower. There's very little arable land on the reservation. Much less than 10% of the reservation land is farmable. We have done feasibility studies for another project. It would be a significant one. It will probably be 20 years before the prices are such that it will warrant the development of that project, but the tribes would intend to do this, and this would, we believe, make it almost impossible to construct that project because of the difficulties that it will cause in financing of projects. I've been involved in financing of these projects and cogeneration projects, and that power sale contract is absolutely essential to obtain financing. And unless you can show the financing agency, whether that's state DOE, or a bank, that you have a steady stream of income
that is not subject to capricious change by the PUC, they are not going to finance it. In addition, this bill will not prevent unneeded projects from being built because the avoided cost mechanism already does that. We're below 2 cents right now, and it's going to be at least a decade before there are going to be any new major projects that are going to be financeable. What it will do is when we do have the next energy shortage and when we do need the power, then this bill will make it much more difficult to develop that power. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Question. Thank you very much for being here. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bill Vianne, Douglas County Commissioner. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to express some concern over Senate Bill 1035. I think we have a unique situation in Douglas County, and I'm not quite sure whether Senator Thorne's proposed changes will make that more palatable to us. We've recently built a 5-megawatt hydropower dam in Douglas County that was financed through about a third county funds and about a third loan from the Bureau of Reclamation and the other third grants from the Bureau of Reclamation. And in order to get that built and to guarantee repayment of that loan, we entered into a 40-year contract with the Bureau of Reclamation. And we also entered into a contract with Pacific Power and Light at a rate that was quite desirable to us a couple of 3 years ago. However, with this bill, if that figure were juggled, it would cause us a great deal of difficulty in meeting that obligation. And I don't know what the Bureau of Reclamation, how they would view that. Of course, the facility is built. We understand that, but it would be difficult for us to reach into our unpredicted future general funds in the county and make those payments. So that, I think, in a nutshell, I know you're very pressed for time. In a nutshell, that is our concern, and for that reason, we would oppose the bill as it was proposed.
When does your contract with Pacific Power expire?
I believe that that's a 20-year contract also. But, of course, when you talk in terms of...